Welcome to the Sanyu Sisters podcast. I'm Tista.
And I'm Amber. And after a crazy 2020, we're so excited that you've joined us for our very first podcast series.
Woohoo! Just to give you some background, we're two friends and early career researchers at the Sanyu Research Unit. Hence our name, the Sanyu Sisters.
We are both so passionate about global maternal and newborn health research, and nothing has hit the research world with quite a bang as COVID-19. And as we prepare for what the post-COVID landscape might look like, it's so important that we take stock of everything that we've learned.
So over the next 10 episodes, join us as we chat to a host of maternal and newborn health researchers across the globe to find out how they have managed to sidestep COVID and keep their research on track. Each week, we will follow the research cycle from starting out and building your research question right through to disseminating your key findings.
And we really want to keep in touch with you to hear what you think or any questions or comments that you may have from anything that we speak about in our podcast.
So please do follow us on Twitter at Sanyu Sisters or Instagram at Sanyu Sisters Podcast, just to keep that dialogue going.
So, to kick things off, let's start at the beginning, where Tista is going to be speaking with David Macunha about how early researchers starting out during COVID were able to keep their projects on track.
I'd like to welcome and introduce our first guest, David Macunha, who is a senior lecturer in public health at Busatema University in Uganda. David trained to be a doctor at Makerere University, where he was awarded the honour of Most Outstanding Student in 2010. He's since found his passion for research and co-authored over 20 publications in maternal, newborn and child health. And he was recently awarded a PhD in Paediatric Global Health from the University of Bergen for his work in newborn care practices in northern Uganda. Most recently, he's been busy setting up the baby gel randomised controlled trial based in eastern Uganda, and following the COVID pandemic, has recently developed a sub-study called Baby COVID. And despite all of this, he's managed to find a few minutes to chat to us. So thank you, David, for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's an honour.
No, the honour is definitely ours. I just wanted to catch up with you and see how your work is going.
So our work is waking up from the COVID slumber. We are adjusting. And I must say that as regards to research, we have now turned the curve.
Amazing.
We are waking up. Our research ethics boards have opened. Everybody has come to a realization that research must continue because it's integral to healthcare provision, particularly in low and middle income countries.
Do you think, David, that the pandemic has changed or diverted what your research interests are?
Yes, and I'll just give a little background to how I see the pandemic as an early career scientist. So for the past 5 years, there has been a lot of tension from researchers in low and middle income countries, because in every meeting we have been going to, they have been telling us that funding is going down, interests in global health funding are waning. And we totally understand that healthcare is political, and obviously healthcare funding is very political because it's regulated usually by parliament and that kind of thing. Personally, I felt a sense of that sense of oneness as a globe in terms of health, that sense of realization that we are one body when it comes to health was slowly dying out. And it could be fatigue. You know, people have been contributing to global health a long time. People in Europe are also having their own challenges. Their economies are going down, you know. It was palpable, the sense of we can't do it this anymore. We are tired, you know. Find something else. The USA is the biggest funder of global health, funding things like Global Fund and the like. It has been giving about $11 billion. But now they're planning to cut it to $7 billion for 2021. And that won't only be for the USA. It was going to be, or it's a plan for most countries to reduce their global health budgets.
Mm-hmm.
So when the pandemic comes in, there is a sense of hope. It comes with challenges, but with a ray of hope. Because there is a realization that we should pay attention to the health of other countries.
Mm-hmm.
Because whether it's in China, in Wuhan, whether it's in Uganda, it could have an impact on the entire world. So that realization that we are one body in terms of health became acute and became very important.
Mm-hmm.
Then we saw an awakening of political interest in health. It's happened at the global scale, but also at the meso and the micro scale, mm-hmm. you know, our governments. Now they started talking about health. They started talking about the local researcher.
Mm-hmm.
They started talking about our own researchers. You know, that's the language that they started using. They started talking about the need to develop our own vaccine. Mm-hmm. The need, it can be a, we can look at it in a bad way that people may become more nationalistic, but from where I come from, there has been a sort of dependency on Western funding. So this nationalization or national interest mm-hmm. in health is a big welcome. So talks of the health system awakened.
Mm-hmm.
And also the funding in local health research from the government is at its highest.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, it has changed the research interests of the country.
Mm.
It has changed the research interests of our institution. So definitely it has changed my research interests, because now I have to look at how
mm-hmm.
how it interacts with COVID. What's the relationship between COVID and maternal and newborn health? What happens when babies get COVID?
Mm-hmm.
How has COVID affected healthcare utilization, you know? I've extended my research interest to cover COVID-relevant questions.
Yeah. So that's very interesting to talk about how you've adapted in these changing times and actually try to involve COVID into the work that you're already conducting. Is this what sort of sparked the idea for baby COVID?
Yes. So previously, Professor Andrew Wicks from the University of Liverpool had come up with this brilliant idea that we can use alcohol-based hand rub to prevent newborn infections.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important newborn infections at that point were bacterial infections.
Mm-hmm.
So when COVID comes in, we are like, wait a minute, how can it affect the SARS-CoV-2 virus, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. It was sort of a very coincidental thing, but very relevant, because the intervention had biological plausibility to COVID. So it was a sort of adapting what we are studying and extending it to become COVID relevant, because that's the most important public health problem now, at least from the eyes of the public and the funders.
Yeah. For you, David, obviously this aligned perfectly in terms of COVID research. For some of your colleagues that are carrying out maternal health or newborn health research, have they had to adapt to develop research questions that are to do with COVID?
So this is it's a transitioning process, because we have been with COVID for about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning, there was a reluctance to change boat.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody and every researcher had this mentality that this is going to pass and we're going to go back to business. But slowly and slowly with time, there is a realization that this could be there for a very long time.
Yeah.
And its interest could be present for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
So every single day I see people, some of my colleagues, jumping ship to the COVID ship. And maybe I'll say something. I didn't jump ship personally immediately, because I became more aware that we are doing this not for us, but for the public. Previously, a researcher like myself would go into the literature, look for something that intrigues me, and research about that.
Mm.
But I've come to realize, still throughout this COVID period, that there are research priorities, that you can do it the other way. You can find out what is of utmost importance to the people currently,
mm-hmm.
To try to be responsive, to meet the needs of the current time. Because if
as global health we don't answer to this current time, then our relevance will be questioned in the future. Because they'll ask, when we needed you most, what answer did you have? All my friends who are not health workers, their memes are now, what have you people done for us in terms of COVID-19? How useful is your PhD, you know? Are you also hiding under the bed? So it's it's more like being a security guard and there is a robbery next door. You don't say, no, I guard the supermarket. You're expected to utilize some of the skills you have to the current situation if you are to be forgiven in future, but also to announce your relevance. So more and more, every single day, more people are attempting, because it's also not very easy to change, because you have to find a way of how your research aligns and apply for funding, all those kind of things. But I'm seeing more and more attempts.
Which is fantastic for us as a global health community to be able to be that responsive. I mean, you touched on funding being sometimes a barrier to being able to conduct research.
Yes.
Have you found that during the COVID-19 more funding has become available to doing COVID work?
Yes. During this COVID, we have applied for this baby COVID grant. But you see an ease. You sense more directness in the funding. People are like, we have this funding call, we'll get back to you within a month, and you should start within another month. You don't have to fill in this long form, just send an email. It's revolutionary.
Yeah.
It's becoming more accessible. It's becoming more, especially COVID funding. Yeah. You no longer have to go through a very tedious process. And also the calls. There is a sort of coalition of importance of COVID funding. People are coming together and say, let's fund this thing. So I pray and hope that this spirit will extend beyond COVID to other global health challenges.
Are there new funding bodies that you've become aware of as a result of COVID? So you've described that there are new bodies coming together, but are there any new funding bodies that you've become aware of that you didn't know of before?
Yes, it's in two directions. It's one, the funding bodies, but the two, the divisions within the existing funding bodies. So there is the African Academy of Sciences. It has come out to give out some funding. That MRSC gay co-funding coming. Even in the old funding bodies like NIH, they are now special COVID-19 focus and emphasis. Yeah, so there are some that have come up, but also the usual suspects coming back with a focus on COVID-19. It has been exciting.
Definitely.
But also our own government and our local universities have started giving very small funding. It may be small, but it's also extremely important. They call out for calls for $4,000 to study COVID, $5,000, $10,000. And there is it can answer a research question. So it has been extremely exciting. Yeah. So we'll try to keep looking for funding for this very important question.
And I think that the decolonization of global health is a fantastic opportunity that perhaps COVID has presented. Do you feel that this has been a positive example in Uganda? Is this something that you have definitely benefited from and something you would hope would continue?
Yes. One, we have benefited a lot from that. And it all starts from the near total lockdown of the world. It starts from around March, where all countries have cut their borders. Supplies cannot come. We don't know whether we'll get medicines. And then it becomes a political emergency.
Yeah.
What do we have to do? People ask, what do we need? Masks? Can't we make masks? What do we need? Knowledge? Can't we generate knowledge? How much would it need to generate knowledge?
Yeah.
And then they realize there are some researchers who are actually researching related work, you know? Can we support them to answer this question, but also to show that we are doing something, because it's really political now, yeah? And political doesn't have to be bad, but yes, it becomes a very urgent political thing. And now you hear politicians boasting of our researchers. Such language wasn't very common, you know? Our vaccine, it wasn't very common. Our funding bodies, that wasn't very common. So it is something that is very positive. I have benefited from it. I believe it will, I also pray, I'm very positive. And I pray that it will continue. Because research doesn't have to be very expensive.
No.
It doesn't have to be. From national budgets, a small proportion could answer very important questions. So I'm praying that that spirit of independence in research continues. We have been dependent on aid. Take ownership of not only health, but also research of knowledge generation, and be active contributors to the global health knowledge cosmos.
Yeah.
So I believe it's a change that is going to continue and will continue. Yeah, but also the public has realized that we need knowledge. We need to know.
Mm-hmm.
One, they have realized that there are things that we don't know.
Yeah.
And we need to know. And there is a process to know.
Yeah.
That also helps in cooperation with research.
Absolutely. And building on that topic of trying to generate knowledge and interest in trying to uncover these questions that exist and learn from them, has there been a push from Ugandan students to do more PhDs or masters or research qualifications? And is there the capacity to support this?
One, there is capacity to develop that, because there has been local capacity that has been built up. Has there been a push?
Mm-hmm.
They had first closed all institutions. Then they realized that the students are part of the workforce, of the health workforce.
Mm-hmm.
They are sort of the reserve in an army. If you're having a war, you can't tell your reserve to go and hide in the house. You know, you have to bring up the reserve.
Yeah.
So they reopened health institutions on that premise.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope that there will be an extension to encouraging students to come and join. There is an urgent realization that we need people to study this COVID-related kind of thing and healthcare-related kind of thing. That realization is there.
Mm.
We hope that there is also a funding line, because there's one thing for a need, but we also need to put a plan and money to it. But the capacity is growing.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen a number of capacity building calls that are asking for people to build capacity in epidemiology.
Yeah.
We realize that research, epidemiology, that kind of inquiry is extremely vital to the survival of our time. So there has been that call, and I'm positive that the funding, more funding, especially local funding, will continue. Right now, in the funding atmosphere, there is funding to do something now, funding to answer the question and answer it fast. We hope that the second phase would be funding to make sure that when such a situation comes again, we can handle it. Because now the focus is survival.
Mm-hmm.
Then from surviving, we should go to strengthening, to prevention, to resilience, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that next time we are better handled to transition into epidemic and pandemic research.
Mm. Which is fascinating that it's not just these research questions that are clinical, you know, in terms of can we make a vaccine? Can we make a treatment? It is actually those wider health system factors that are pertinent in being able to develop a strategy to improve care in the future, which is definitely translating to other aspects of maternal and newborn care. As the listeners will know, you're a medic as well. And do you think your time balance that you've had between research and clinical work has changed at all from the pandemic?
Yes. So I have mainly been focusing on research, because our initial strategy as a country was to prevent. With
lockdowns with masks, with social, with physical distancing. The pandemic hasn't reached that point in Uganda where the hospitals are overflowing. So the focus has been more public health, more prevention rather than clinical, because the clinics haven't become overrun. But in the event that that takes place, the Ministry of Health has told us that they will be calling upon us at any point to change duties, you know, to shift from more of the research roles to the clinical.
Okay, so that's really interesting, because I think that's one thing to sort of bear in mind with the COVID pandemic is that it is not the same. The pandemic wave has changed dramatically across the last, you know, 6-7 months. Where there are different stages and phases, and actually the responses at each of these phases will be slightly different, and that will change globally depending on, you know, which country you're in and what the rates are and the transmission is.
Previously, there was some bit of divide. There were people who are mainly in research and the people who are mainly in clinical care, and there was just a very small overlap. But when COVID came, we saw an increase in the purely clinical people to venture into research, and the team that was more bent towards research to bend back into clinical work. So the intersection is getting bigger, and which becomes very beautiful for science.
So that again is another opportunity that this pandemic has presented, is that unification of two different disciplines. What would you say is one thing that through the pandemic you've learned that you're hoping to take forward when creating research projects or developing research questions in the future?
Maybe I'll talk about two.
Brilliant, please.
One thing that I've learned is the importance of risk management planning. We talked about it, we thought about it, but I had never appreciated the importance and the vitality. Risk on the side of the project, but also risk of the participants. What happens to our participants? Slightly moving beyond our small spheres. Because right now, for every project, we have to say, do we foresee any eventualities? Do we foresee any harm to our research subjects just by our interaction? So for example, in previous research, things like hand hygiene were not explicitly put. And we are going to go into the field and interact with newborns. I've done a lot of newborn research. You go and measure them, you touch them. But there is we didn't have very strict risk mitigation plans to prevent transmitting infections to the newborns. These things like moving on with with alcohol-based hand rubs should have been there, you know? So this aspect of risk in a sort of a bigger way, I think to me, it's something that I'm going to take away from this pandemic. Yeah. To think how I'm of risk to the participant, how the participant may be of risk to me and our research assistants, and how the environment and eventualities could be of risk. How do we mitigate them? The second thing is the importance of being prepared. I think it's your Prime Minister, Benjamin Disraeli, who said that the secret to success is being ready when opportunity comes. I realize that it's extremely important to be ready so that when opportunity strikes, you can easily harness that opportunity. Because one thing that we have come to realize is the people who have harnessed the most from this pandemic are the ones who are prepared in different aspects. So it was very easy to jump ship. It was very easy to integrate COVID. It was very easy to become relevant to the current day and time.
Yeah.
So those are the two things that I have really appreciated about this pandemic.
And is there anything, David, that you think when you're forming future research questions that you've now developed as a result of this COVID pandemic?
Yes. There are a couple of things that I'm sort of thinking about because of this pandemic. I'm really interested in newborn health, and I've been looking a lot at newborn infections. the relationship between the infections in the mother and the infections in the newborn and infections from around the other household members, that's something that I've become more aware of in these periods. We have previously known it, but that importance of trying to find out these relationships, how do bugs flow from the mother to the baby, and how can we prevent them? So to sort of have a more holistic research focus, not only focusing on one small aspect, but trying to see how your research aspect interacts with other elements.
And I think that's hugely important, because I think that often in research, what we do is we block people into categories, don't we? And we sort of say, you're a maternal health specialist and you're a newborn health specialist, or you work with stillbirths. And actually that integration across these categories is vital to be able to find sustainable solutions and improvements.
Yes, it's collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
The pandemic has drawn us physically apart, but more and more we realize we are actually becoming closer.
Mm-hmm.
So previously we had this thinking and belief in physical meetings, but because we wouldn't meet physically, we took to, I think we'll call this generation the Zoom, the Zoomization of society. You know?
Yeah.
We talk to Zoom and realize we can actually have short Zoom meetings more frequently, mm-hmm. instead of physical meetings more distant. Then realize, but why did we even need physical meetings? Then realize we actually have more meetings than we used to have. Then realize we can actually involve more people.
Yeah.
We can actually, collaboration can become smoother, physically apart, but virtually closer, you know, and there's a net intimate gain. Yeah. So that's one thing that I've come to realize, that people have become more open to collaborating with people they have never physically met, because it's becoming common practice not to meet people physically, but meet them online.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it has created a new sphere of collaboration, a new space. It was there, but it wasn't utilized a lot, especially from us from low-income countries. But now we have broken that glass, that we have passed that barrier of limitation. I must say, I wasn't a big fan of virtual meetings before. Yeah, I was a bit hesitant. I thought, why don't we just meet in person and the like? But now that that's not an important, that's not an option. Wow, I've realized the power of the virtual space. More and more I'm attending, having collaborations with people from so many countries. So that's something that I will continue with after the pandemic is gone.
Brilliant. That's a fantastic point to end on, is this idea of unity, collaboration, and working together for solutions that are useful for mothers and babies globally. So thank you so much, David, for joining us today and for really bringing a wealth of experience, expertise, and actually just personal anecdotes on how this process has affected you in Uganda.
Thank you so much. It has been a pleasure.
And if you'd like to hear anything further from David, I'm sure he'd be keen to filter through any questions that you might have. So please do get in contact with us on the Twitter or Instagram page with any comments or questions to keep this dialogue going. So, Amber, what did you think?
That was fantastic. I thought it was a really interesting point that David made about Zoomization and the positives that he has found from everything going online. And I think it really has opened up a whole host of opportunities for the global health community. And especially thinking about collaboration, which is so, so crucial as we move forward with this.
Absolutely.
I loved what he said about having frequent quick calls as opposed to perhaps meeting every quarter. And actually that ability to include so many more people in our calls.
Yeah.
And I know that Professor Weeks will be with us in one of our episodes, and he'll be sharing his thoughts about his experiences with online platforms. What about you, Tista?
Yeah, I was really fascinated and actually inspired by his positivity. that the COVID-19 had actually been an energizing force for the global health community through inspiring additional funding, as well as galvanizing the spirit at country level to harness their own resources, creating vaccines, or indeed investing in knowledge. And it's this concept of decolonization of health that is something that's so relevant at the moment. And we're lucky that we're able to touch on this later in one of our future episodes. I think it's key and something that has definitely come more to the forefront during the COVID-19 pandemic. So that was really fascinating to hear.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much in there, isn't there, that's food for thought. And we would love to know what you thought at home. If you really enjoyed today's episode, please let us know on our Twitter account at Sanyu Sisters or via Instagram at Sanyu Sisters Podcast to really keep that conversation going, because I think there's so much to be explored.
Absolutely. And next week, Amber will be speaking to Hannah McCauley, who is a midwife and researcher at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine and making some serious waves in antenatal and postnatal care in Togo. Hannah's going to be giving us her insights on how she managed to navigate the various approvals and governance processes during the pandemic. So we can't wait for you to join us then. Until next time.